Well, let's turn to our material, if we can. We're coming to what we might call a fourth episode in John. Fourth block of material, chapters 7 to 8. Third episode, the third large block, was that whole long thing in chapter 6 on the bread of life. Its theme was bread of life. The main theme that comes out in chapters 7 and 8 is a revelation or a manifestation of Jesus. He, more than before, talks directly about who he is. And these two chapters demonstrate then how as he does that, he is rejected. Jews, Pharisees, others, now calling the question whether or not they can follow Jesus. This rejection theme was anticipated in the previous section, in chapter 6, as we saw last time, namely in those last verses in which even the disciples, now hearing Jesus talk about himself as the bread of life, find, as the New English Bible translates, that they could not stomach what Jesus said. To understand John and to understand the Gospels in the New Testament, seems to me one has to, by all means, bring out the notion that the confrontation with Jesus as the Christ divides people between those who can accept him and those who can or must reject him. And it gives one sort of real pause to read in chapter 6 that the disciples who went about with him, and again that means disciples in the broader sense than just the 12, that those who knew him certainly much more intimately than we can know him in a way, couldn't understand and therefore had to reject. Well, in chapter 7 to 8, that is enlarged upon, namely the notion of rejection. But it's shown also in a context in which Jesus, a little bit more, goes further and further trying to say who and what he is. In this group of chapters, the tone has grown a lot more polemical. What does polemical mean?
Accusing,
in a way. Where are our Greek students here? Polemos. What does that mean? Anybody know what a polemos is? Who said that? That's right. A polemos is a war. So if something grows more polemic in tone, it grows more disputation-like. Jesus and his opponents are squaring off against one another, a little bit fiercer than they had. The outward structure of this set of chapters is less finely delineated than the others. But you don't have that usual Johannine way of having a narrative and then a very definite long discourse which relates to the narrative and explains it and where Jesus preaches and preaches. You have narrative and discourse elements, but you have in this a less clearly organized set of passages. Its structure is not so very clearly known. Actually, chapter 7 to 8 is the midpoint or the mid-block within the larger book of signs. And that's the larger context into which it fits. Well, before we turn to the assignment, not assignment sheet, but some of the study questions that I gave you as a suggestion of certain elements in the text that one should consider and ponder, and we'll want to turn to those in a moment. I'd like us to look over chapters 7 and 8 just a bit, in a general way. According to chapter 7, what is the setting of this whole period? What's the historical setting? All right. I might add this to the board. The setting is the Feast of Tabernacles. As any New Testament or Old Testament reader will have gathered, there are in the Old Testament and in Judaism a whole spate of important festivals and festivals and feasts which mark a certain period in Jewish religion. The one that's been mentioned before a couple of times is of course the Passover. Passover is narrated in Exodus 12, if you want to review what that was really all about. The Feast of Tabernacles is the setting for Jesus coming to Jerusalem, and he is coming to Jerusalem in chapter 7 to 8, and that's where all this business takes place. It says that at the very outset, afterwards Jesus went about in Galilee. He wished to avoid Judea because the Jews were looking for a chance to kill him. You know, one can't read that too quickly. One can't pass over that without stopping for a second. Since we know how the story's going to end, we don't let that bother us very much. But I think that we ought to pretend for a moment that we don't know how the story is going to end, and therefore let the impact of the notion that what Jesus has been narrated as doing in his life up to this point has agitated authorities and opponents and religious people enough that his life is being plotted for. That's rather potent stuff that we usually slip right by us, and it won't have the proper meaning for the reader unless you imagine for a second that you're a disciple who really doesn't understand and doesn't know what is going to happen after the death. That the prospective death of the master, of the rabbi, of this messianic figure is not going to be a glorious death at all, but that it will mean the end of the Jesus movement as far as they are concerned, if you suppose that they do not fully understand what the end is going to mean. And every indication in John and the Synoptics is that people don't understand that it has to be that Jesus dies. I mean, if he is the inaugurator of the Messianic age, and if he is in some sense the Messiah, even though it's not the full Jewish sense, even though he's reinterpreted it, nevertheless, a prospective death for Jesus is the... It means to call everything that he's done into question. And it means ultimately that, and outwardly, that God's putting a stamp of rejection on Jesus. Jewish law says anybody who leads such a crummy life that they end up hanging on the gallows must be cursed by God. And so that would be the only way they could understand that. Well, if it's at the Feast of the Tabernacles, what indeed is the Feast of Tabernacles? Someone? What are some of the themes or emphases? You've got to know what that is. You're going to make sense of some of the New Testament. They talk about it. The Old Testament does as well. What in the history of the Jewish people, for example, was the beginning point of tabernacle? What in the world is a tabernacle? Jim?
When Moses was on Mount Sinai and he came down, he had very precise instructions for the kind of tent that they were built for the dwelling while they were moving through the desert.
All right, the Lord is said to have dwelt in a tabernacle. But there's more to the Feast of Tabernacles than that, if you had a tent of meeting, as it's sometimes called. Who was it, Marcy, that had your hand?
Well, I was just going to say that it was the tent that housed the Ark of Covenant.
But it wasn't in the, that's not in the plural. I mean, you're saying the same thing that Jim is saying, essentially. This is not the Feast of the Tabernacle, but the Feast of Tabernacles. What was it? What is a tabernacle, anyhow? That's a fancy word. Or sometimes it's called booth. Booth. What were these booths or tabernacles? Please?
That was the name of the house.
when the food and laundry what they lived in the tent, and to remember that time when they lived in their common land.
Okay, historically there was the fact that the Jews, as they wandered, or the Hebrews we should say, really, as they wandered the 40 years in the desert between the time of the Exodus and between the crossing then of the Jordan and the settlement in the land, that 40 years of wandering that is narrated primarily in the book of Numbers, where Moses led them through thick and thin, there are examples there of a time when they, for protection against the climactic conditions of the desert, built themselves little wooden or some kind of booths or tabernacles. And later, after they settled into the land, as they looked back on their history, as we are wont to do, as we either collectively or individually look back upon our own history, there came a time when they reflected on that past as a particular time of religious meaning and significance, when they perceived that, though at the time it wasn't so clear, that Yahweh was in fact with them and blessing them, etc. And so they would have a celebration of memory. Most of the times a festival or a celebration, a feast, is a time you set aside to recall the past. And indeed, not just to recall the past, but to somehow bring the past up into the present and to make it real. And indeed, when one studies the religion of the Old Testament people, one realizes that particular thing of taking the past and recalling it now and making it present very much belonged to their religious beliefs. It also belongs to Christian beliefs. We've inherited that from our Hebrew forefathers and foremothers. Sacrament of the Lord's Supper is not just a little memorial meal in which we think, oh, how great it was when Jesus was here. And wasn't it nice as he celebrated that Last Supper with his disciples? And we can kind of remember that. That would be a pale understanding of our memorial meal. Because in Hebrew conception, the notion of memory, of calling to remembrance, was not just, oh, let's think about that and recollect that for a moment. It was rather for them, in a genuine sense, to take something out of the past and make it real and present today. And to let the past and its significance have an informing and powerful significance for our religious life now. Now, this Feast of the Tabernacles was that sort of thing, where later on they celebrated their past history with Yahweh and looked back to all the mighty deeds that Yahweh had done, and one of them had to do with that whole desert sojourn. And so when they would have their festival, they would make little booths for a whole week or so. And that would be reminiscent for them of the past. The past was important because then Yahweh had acted, and they believed that he still did so in the present. Now, we're no longer, however, in the Old Testament time, when we come to the time of Jesus. We're into a Jewish period in which things have gradually changed and evolved, and the Feast of the Tabernacles has taken on other significant aspects. Who else knows something about that?
Their harvest, Thanksgiving festival.
All right. It takes place traditionally at a harvest time. Anything else involved with it, Chris?
Well, Marsh is saying that even the people who lived in Jerusalem went out and lived in the fields, which I thought was pretty neat. That not only the pilgrims, but even the people who had houses and stuff. But he also talked about drawing from that golden vessel, drawing water from the well from that golden vessel. That was the water, and then the candlesticks, the golden candlesticks that they had lit in every courtyard.
Okay.
And so those were references that I make to being the living one.
Legitimate concern. I guess I'd want to, however, keep things in a paradoxical or dialectical way, and also say, on the one hand, holding what you say is valid, but also say that the only way that you can read the Bible is with your brain, in a sense. That is to say, the Bible is made of words, it's a document, to be sure it's the Word of God, but you don't digest the Bible through some other part of your body except your head. Now, we would want to say that you never use your reason, your brain, to stand in judgment of the Word. But it's certainly the faculty through which you do come to understanding. Of course, the Christian belief, which I would support, would be that you don't only apprehend the Word of God with your reason, but I guess in order to speak, well, we use the poetic phrase, the heart, in order to try to say that apprehending the Bible is a whole lot more than reading it like you read a mathematics textbook or something else. That apprehending the Bible is not simply a mental process, it's a spiritual one. That's what we mean to say. Amen. And that's really true. But I guess I would urge on us, in spite of the fact that there may be difficulties in, say, things as to how we would understand them or questions of whether or not this or that is meant literally or symbolically or whatever, that nevertheless the interpretative process is one which we oughtn't to shy away from, and we shouldn't feel that there's somehow something dirty about asking, you know, what is the meaning of that word? Does it communicate to me what it was originally intended to, or is there some other way I have to put that? That's kind of my concern. Patty?
I was going to say that it seems that too often Christians are afraid to question and they're afraid to be troubled, as though that's an indication of weakness. And I think it's an indication of strength. In the sense that if the weather gets rough, you can bend and you can grow, you don't have to snap and break. And we're dealing in an educated world for the most part. And I think if we're going to seem like a viable way of looking, you know, of faith or whatever, we're going to have to be able to deal with other people's questions with more than just a pat trite answer. You know, we can't put blinders on and say, I can't listen to that kind of question. That's, you know, ridiculous. We could say, hey, yeah, I came up with that question too, and this is how I resolved it, or maybe I haven't resolved it yet. But I think that Christians, they're getting almost flabby in their, you know, in their position, in their stance. And I think it's an exciting strength in question.
I think one thing that to leave yourself open to too is to be surprised at God coming to you, particularly on things he would have you do through listening to prayer. I guess and talking about demons, I would never have believed in their existence, you know, and I just felt in prayer once led to pray for someone, and I didn't visually see, but the demon left the person, and I never would have believed in that if I wouldn't have witnessed it with my own eyes. I would have thought a lot of that was false, you know, or just something that I could intellectualize, and it's not something of power that I have to fear as a Christian. But I feel like to me now it's something that I have to be open to. That there is that possibility. It's not to say all sicknesses make bad answers, all sicknesses is because of demons or all this or that. But that in our role of not miserable Christians but ministering Christians, we might be called into that point at some time. I guess leaving yourself open to that. To me it means that, and there's also miracles that I've seen occur. That I can't send miracles out of the past. At least I can't for my own self, because I've seen them with my eyes. You know, I felt them, I touched them, tasted them. That I can't say it's all in the realm of the past, but I have to say that it's a power that exists today and in my own life. I have that witness. And it's not to pound that into somebody else's head when they ask questions, it's to be very willing to listen and to be quiet about it at times. But sometimes I think within our own brothers and sisters of Christians, we don't share those miracles. We don't share those things that we have normally from our God. Mm-hmm.
It's really, I guess, to me, leaving all options open to God instead of limiting him and saying, he will only work in this way, or he will only work in this way. He'll work the way he chooses. My role is to be open, and I have to be open to receive the way in which he is having received.
Karen?
Is there a difference then in the way we somehow didn't know we approach the resurrection as opposed to all the rest of the family? And is it is there a difference in the way we approach it, or is it like when you and I were talking about this earlier, you talked about the gift of the grace and the faith that embraces that, and that in some sense an inexplicable gift of God that we can, that there's a certitude in the way we affirm the resurrection. It's not a uncertain as I was holding it to be at that point. In a very different way than we would maybe approach, the most of us would maybe approach the question of demons, and yet in some sense Barb is able to approach it in the same sort of certitude somehow. Can you get a question out of that?
Yeah. I think so. I don't know, you know, maybe your answer to go is 5 after 12. If you want to go, you may. I'll talk about that. But don't feel embarrassed if you've got to go to the bathroom or you've got to go do dishes or want to go sleep. It doesn't matter. We've run the blue ship around here. But as far as your question is concerned, that's a helpful question, and I'll try to rephrase it and then maybe comment on it. And if you want to go now. I'll go later. The thing that I'm very intrigued about as a teacher and as a Christian is the interpretative question, and it's essentially, it can be raised in many different ways. We're raising it in these last half hour or hour. We're raising it in the form of, what in the Bible is do you have to really believe, and what maybe is dispensable? That'd be one crass way to put it. But yet it's a legitimate question. What I think you're wanting to address is, okay, we all sort of know that the resurrection of Jesus is the central miracle, central thing about the New Testament. It is an article of faith without which you can't have anything else. That is to say, it would be hard for me and maybe for many of us to conceive of a person who would think of themselves as a Christian unless they in some way affirm the reality of the notion of Jesus' resurrection. And you could talk about the reality of it in probably all sorts of ways that would fit very literal or very liberal ideas. But the question, having said that much, the question becomes, well, how do you distinguish between certain articles of faith and certain others? And I think that's a crucial question, and let me try not to be too obscure now. I'm trying to think of some examples to illustrate what I want to say. We've been raising the question of the worldview of the Bible and the language that it uses to talk about the things it wants to talk about. What I've been trying to hint at is this, that the Bible does not, the New Testament does not say many things. It says essentially one thing. It says that one thing in quite a variety of ways. It's intent on doing one thing to us, though it may do it in many different ways. And the Bible, in wanting to get across one central thing, uses a whole realm of language much of which belongs to its own day and age, and much of which is clearly understandable by people in the 20th century. The question that lurks behind the uneasiness of many of us, however, at all this, is how do you tell what in the Bible is essential for the Christian to believe, and how do you tell what is maybe non-essential or on the periphery? In other words, to go back to another illustration that we used a moment ago, is belief in six-day creation on the same spiritual level as belief in the resurrection or the deity of Jesus? Or, to bring it closer to our discussion, is belief, is intellectual assent about real demons that enter in and come out of people, is a belief in that the same as the belief in the deity of Christ or the resurrection? Or we could just, you know, keep pairing different things along with that. We happen to be on demons because it speaks of Jesus as being possessed or wacky, kind of language you prefer. Seems to me the central task of the theologian and the interpreter when it comes to biblical stuff is to talk about and to raise questions and to attempt answers to what is the essence of the Christian message. Now, I guess what I would like a person to see is that it's possible to affirm the centrality of the New Testament's message without necessarily buying into its mythological view of the world. And we, in fact, really don't, usually. We don't believe the world is flat. But we do retain, some of us, the need to believe in angels and devils. I would, however, like you to at least ascertain the distinction between those two kinds of beliefs. The other day when we talked about faith, trying to distinguish between faith as intellectual assent to dogma or doctrine and faith as trust in God or in Christ as Lord. And there are two different orders, two different realms, two different kinds of belief. And most of us, largely because of our background in Sunday school and who knows wherever else, we get those two things constantly confused. So the kind of faith in God that the Bible is after, and the openness that you're talking about, and the belief in the all-encompassing power of God, etc., that's one thing. But the yes or the no to a specific doctrine or formulation or item from the New Testament worldview, that I would like us to see as quite another. Now, for the people who have no difficulty here, that's fine. But there are many people in the outside world who would like to buy into Christianity, but are prevented from doing so because they think that if you buy into the Christ message, you've got to buy into the mythology. And I have wanted to raise the question of whether or not that's so for you to think about. The answer that you come up with, of course, is an answer that each of you will decide on the basis of a lot of things. My job as teacher is to goad you into thinking. Not necessarily my job to resolve it for you, because I may not be able to. Well, we'll have examples later in John of the same kind of problem, but with a different detail. And we'll deal with that sort of as we come along. Okay, see you tomorrow at 10:30. Well, let's turn to our material, if we can. We're coming to what we might call a fourth episode in John. Fourth block of material, chapters 7 to 8. Third episode, the third large block, was that whole long thing in chapter 6 on the bread of life. Its theme was bread of life. The main theme that comes out in chapters 7 and 8 is a revelation or a manifestation of Jesus. He, more than before, talks directly about who he is, and these two chapters demonstrate then how as he does that, he is rejected. The Jews, the Pharisees, others, now calling to question whether or not they can follow Jesus. This rejection theme was anticipated in the previous section in chapter 6, as we saw last time, namely in those last verses in which even the disciples, now hearing Jesus talk about himself as the bread of life, find, as the New English Bible translates, that they could not stomach what Jesus said. To understand John and to understand the Gospels in the New Testament, seems to me, one has to, by all means, bring out the notion that the confrontation with Jesus as the Christ divides people between those who can accept him and those who can or must reject him. And it gives one sort of real pause to read in chapter 6 that the disciples who went about with him, and again that means disciples in the broader sense than just the 12, that those who knew him certainly much more intimately than we can know him in a way, couldn't understand and therefore had to reject. Well, in chapter 7 to 8, that is enlarged upon, namely the notion of rejection. But it's shown also in a context in which Jesus, a little bit more, goes further and further trying to say who and what he is. In this group of chapters, the tone has grown a lot more polemical. What does polemical mean?
Accusing?
In a way. Where are our Greek students here? Polemos. What does that mean? Anybody know what a polemos is? Who said that?
John.
That's right.
That's the black.
A polemos is a war. So if something grows more polemic in tone, it grows more disputation-like. Jesus and his opponents are squaring off against one another, a little bit fiercer than they had. The outward structure of this set of chapters is less finely delineated than the others. But you don't have that usual Johannine way of having a narrative and then a very definite long discourse which relates to the narrative and explains it and where Jesus preaches and preaches. You have narrative and discourse elements, but you have in this a less clearly organized set of passages. Its structure is not so very clearly known. Actually, chapter 7 to 8 is the midpoint or the mid-block within the larger book of signs. And that's the larger context into which it fits. Well, before we turn to the assignment, not assignment sheet, but some of the study questions that I gave you as a suggestion of certain elements in the text that one should consider and ponder, and we'll want to turn to those in a moment. I'd like us to look over chapters 7 and 8 just a bit, general way. According to chapter 7, what is the setting of this whole period? What's the historical setting?
Feast of Tabernacles.
All right. I might add this to the board. The setting of the Feast of Tabernacles. As any New Testament or Old Testament reader will have gathered, there are in the Old Testament and in Judaism a whole spate of important festivals and festivals and feasts. Which mark a certain period in Jewish religion. The one that's been mentioned before a couple of times of this course is, of course, the Passover. Passover is narrated in Exodus 12, if you want to review what that was really all about. The Feast of Tabernacles is the setting for Jesus coming to Jerusalem, and he is coming to Jerusalem in chapter 7 to 8, and that's where all this business takes place. It says that at the very outset, afterwards Jesus went about in Galilee. He wished to avoid Judea because the Jews were looking for a chance to kill him. You know, one can't read that too quickly. One can't pass over that without stopping for a second. Since we know how the story is going to end, we don't let that bother us very much. But I think that we ought to pretend for a moment that we don't know how the story is going to end, and therefore let the impact of the notion that what Jesus has been narrated as doing in his life up to this point has agitated authorities and opponents and religious people enough that his life is being plotted for. That's rather potent stuff that we usually slip right by us. And it won't have the proper meaning for the reader unless you imagine for a second that you're a disciple who really doesn't understand and doesn't know what is going to happen after the death. That the prospective death of the master, of the rabbi, of this messianic figure is not going to be a glorious death at all, but that it will mean the end of the Jesus movement as far as they are concerned, if you suppose that they do not fully understand what the end is going to mean. And every indication in John and the Synoptics is that people don't understand that it has to be that Jesus dies. I mean, if he is the inaugurator of the Messianic age, and if he is in some sense the Messiah, even though it's not the full Jewish sense, even though he's reinterpreted it, nevertheless, a prospective death for Jesus is the... It means to call everything that he's done into question. And it means ultimately that, or and outwardly, that God's putting a stamp of rejection on Jesus. Jewish law says anybody who leads such a crummy life that they end up hanging on the gallows must be cursed by God. And so that would be the only way they could understand that. Well, if it's at the Feast of the Tabernacles, what indeed is the Feast of Tabernacles? Someone? What are some of the themes or emphases? What, you got to know what that is. You're going to make sense of some of the New Testament. They talk about it. The Old Testament does as well. What in the history of the Jewish people, for example, was the beginning point of tabernacle? What in the world is a tabernacle? Jim?
When Moses was on Mount Sinai and he came down, he had very precise instructions of the kind of tent they were built for the dwelling while they were moving through the desert.
All right, the Lord is said to have dwelt in a tabernacle. But there's more to the Feast of Tabernacles than that, if you had a tent of meeting, as it's sometimes called. Who was it, Marcy, that had your hand?
Well, I was just going to say that it was the tent that housed the Ark of God.
But it wasn't in the, that's not in the plural. I mean, you're saying the same thing that Jim is saying, essentially. This is not the Feast of the Tabernacle, but the Feast of Tabernacles. What was it? What is a tabernacle, anyhow? That's a fancy word. Or sometimes it's called booth. Booth. What were these booths or tabernacles? Please?
Yeah, it was when the Jews were wandering out of the desert, what they lived in, their tents. And they would have to remember that time when they were led to their common land.
Okay, historically there was the fact that the Jews, as they wandered, or the Hebrews we should say, really, as they wandered the 40 years in the desert between the time of the Exodus and between the crossing then of the Jordan and the settlement in the land, that 40 years of wandering that is narrated primarily in the book of Numbers, where Moses led them through thick and thin There are examples there of a time when they, for protection against the climactic conditions of the desert, built themselves little wooden or some kind of booths or tabernacles. And later, after they settled into the land, as they looked back on their history, as we are wont to do, as we either collectively or individually look back upon our own history, there came a time when they reflected on that past as a particular time of religious meaning and significance, when they perceived that, though at the time it wasn't so clear, that Yahweh was in fact with them and blessing them, etc. And so they would have a celebration of memory. Most of the times a festival or a celebration, a feast, is a time you set aside to recall the past. And indeed, not just to recall the past, but to somehow bring the past up into the present and to make it real. And indeed, when one studies the religion of the Old Testament people, one realizes that that particular thing of taking the past and recalling it now and making it present very much belonged to their religious beliefs. It also belongs to Christian beliefs. We've inherited that from our Hebrew forefathers and foremothers. The sacrament of the Lord's Supper is not just a little memorial meal in which we think, oh, how great it was when Jesus was here. And wasn't it nice as he celebrated that Last Supper with his disciples? And we can kind of remember that. That would be a pale understanding of our memorial meal, because in Hebrew conception, the notion of memory, of calling to remembrance, was not just, oh, let's think about that and recollect that for a moment. It was rather for them, in a genuine sense, to take something out of the past and make it real and present today. And to let the past and its significance have an informing and powerful significance for our religious life now. Now, this Feast of the Tabernacles was that sort of thing, where later on they celebrated their past history with Yahweh and looked back to all the mighty deeds that Yahweh had done, and one of them had to do with that whole desert sojourn. And so when they would have their festival, they would make little booths for a whole week or so. And that would be reminiscent for them of the past. The past was important because then Yahweh had acted, and they believed that he still did so in the present. Now, we're no longer, however, in the Old Testament times. When we come to the time of Jesus, we're into a Jewish period in which things have gradually changed and evolved, and the Feast of the Tabernacles has taken on other significant aspects. Who else knows something about that?
Their harvest Thanksgiving festival.
All right. It takes place traditionally at a harvest time. Anything else involved with it, Chris?
Well, Marsh is saying that even the people who lived in Jerusalem went out and lived in these fields, which I thought was pretty neat. That not only the pilgrims, but even the people who had houses and stuff. But he also talked about drawing from that golden vessel, drawing water from the well from that golden vessel. That was the water, and then the candlesticks, the golden candlesticks that they had lit in every courtyard.
Okay.
And so those were references that Christ was making to being the living one and being the light of the world. It's especially appropriate, I guess.
Okay. Anything else? The things that you've mentioned there are pretty significant, probably. If one, as C.H. Dodd suggests, if one sees some of these words of Jesus in chapter 7 and 8, against the backdrop of this Jewish festival, if that is the setting, then Dodd suggests, for example, that Jesus' words about I am living water and I am the light of the world, and then his words I am he, the Greek ego eimi, I am he, that these three significant themes in these chapters take on a greater significance seen against the backdrop of the Jewish festival. That the ceremony of bringing water out of the Siloam pool and then bringing it, carrying it into the temple and pouring it on the burnt offerings, that was one aspect of of the festival belonged to that, having to do with water and the pouring, the libation, pouring out of water, in this case, on the burnt offering. There's some association with that, of course, with rain. What might be the, in a sense, primitive connection between a festival at which one prays for rain and the taking of water from the well and pouring it out on the altar? Is there a connection between those two things? If so, what kind? In the Old Testament, when Elijah on Mount Carmel had his Auseinandersetzung with the Baal prophets, one of their disputes was whose God was more potent, and so they called for fire from their gods, and nothing happened. And then Elijah got prepared to do that, and before he did it, he went and got all this water and poured out on the logs, on the altar. Now, we usually assume that the reason he did that is because if you've got wet, soggy logs, then it's a greater miracle if the deity can ignite those. But that's not the point there at all, because the setting for that whole Elijah, Baal prophet disputation has to do with drought. And it has to do with which god controls nature. And the problem was that the Baal gods of the Canaanites were thought of as nature gods, but Yahweh was not thought of as a nature god by Israel. So if you were a farmer, if you had become an Israelite farmer, you didn't really fool around with Yahweh when it came to the needs of the crops, because Yahweh is a nomadic god, they believed. And what this story is bent on showing is that it is Yahweh who controls nature and rain. So after that whole experiment there, the clouds come up and it rains. Now, what's the connection between the rain and Elijah pouring out the water on those logs?
Does it have to do with the fact that Elijah prayed for the 3.5-year drought?
Yeah, but what's the connection between the pouring of the water and the he's wanting rain to come?
Maybe kind of a symbolic thing, you know, in the old ancient religions, if you were pouring out the water, so God can pour down the water.
Okay, and what's the term we use for that?
So he's making a sacrifice of water, or water.
How about evaporation?
How about sympathetic magic? How about that? How does that grab you? Do you know what sympathetic magic is? Who knows what sympathetic magic is? Somebody must. Do you know? I'm not going to tell. In primitive religion, yes, please. Didn't see your
method of... It's creating a symbol so that, and doing something with the symbol so that you can, on a greater scale, or you know, in a spiritual sense, then something else will happen. Voodooism is an example of this, where you when you stick the pin into an object that is a symbol of another object that supposedly harms the other distant object.
Exactly. You do something on a small scale to try to promote and call forth or evoke, if it's a primitive pagan religion, to try to call forth and evoke the actions of the gods, hoping that there will be sympathetic vibrations, so to speak, that what you're doing here as you invoke and pray and have the incantation or whatever, that will have a cosmic effect. Now, you know, obviously the religion of the Old Testament is not a religion of magic or of paganism, but one sees here a kind of allusion or a reminiscence, a recollection of that kind of practice. And some commentators suggest, in case you're wondering if we're too far off base here, that this Siloam ritual involved with the Tabernacle Festival is not also reminiscent of an earlier sort of magical, sympathetic magic kind of thing. You take water out of the pool, pour it on the sacrificial area in hopes that that will evoke from the deities rain, because rain is connected with this particular festival. Sort of an allusion to it. In any case, its real theological sense here is that the festival is connected with water, and it gives Jesus the chance to say, listen, if you really want to know what the real kind of water is that can promote genuine life, then that's me. I am the living water. I am the light of the world. Also grows out of the notion, probably, in the Festival of Tabernacles, that one of the inner courts of the temple was illuminated, the court of the women, or the women's court. Don't know exactly myself what that was. There were in the temple many different courts. There was the Holy of Holies. There was a court that the Gentiles could come to. If they were Gentiles, they would become Jews. They couldn't go much further than that. The high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. Well, anyway, the illumination, the lighting up of that court, perhaps stands behind the notion that Jesus here is saying, I am the one who really lights up things. I'm the light of the world. Well, back to the text then. As far as its historical setting, it's the Feast of Tabernacles, and that feast lasts about 7 days, and it has historical allusions to the Hebrew past, as well as it has certain rituals and activities that belong in the present. Yes, please.
This isn't directly connected, but I keep noticing that you are making a distinction between Hebrew and Jewish, and I don't know what the distinction is.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about that a second ago. One ought properly to distinguish between, in biblical studies, New and Old Testament, one ought to distinguish between the Hebrew religion on the one hand, and Judaism on the other, and between our word Hebrew or Israelite and Jew. The distinction is one that relates to chronology in a way. Strictly speaking, the emergence of Judaism, and therefore the Jews as a people who are the people of the religion, or the race, belongs after the exile. If you will recall the history of the Israelite people, in the 6th century, in 587 to be exact, 587 BC, foreign powers from Babylon came in to Palestine and overran the temple and the palace, and they annexed Israel, and forever after, ever since then, Israel has never really been an autonomous state. Well, in that then immediately subsequent exile period, where Jews, Hebrews, were transported over into Babylonia, some stayed, the peasants and the farmers stayed, but the rulers and the nobles were exported or deported. That initiated a new period, a new era for the Hebrews, and after that time, even after some of them then returned about 50 years later from exile and came back and resettled in the land about 530 or so, things were different for them. What was different? Well, previously, they had had a temple. It's now been destroyed. Previously, they possessed the land. That had been the gift of Yahweh. That was connected intimately with their religious beliefs. They have, in a sense, been deprived of their land. What do they have left of those things that was most important to them? They've got Torah. And since they don't have anything but Torah, they become, as one scholar has aptly put it, the people of the book, people of the scriptures. And so the Torah, now at this post-exilic period, is elevated in importance for them, and they understand that the losing of the land and the destruction of the temple and this deportation and the pain and the death that they endured, they understood that to be primarily because they had in the past not paid enough attention to Torah and to covenant. So what do you do if you believe that you've really made some bad mistakes in the past? You try to make up for it. And so in the subsequent centuries before Jesus, great attention is given to the rituals, the laws, the keeping of those laws to the letter, and the elevation of the Torah in importance as the book of Moses. Now that, this is Judaism now. This is Judaism emerging with the elevation of the Torah, and connected with that, of course, is the work of Ezra the scribe, especially, as well as with Nehemiah and the later post-exilic prophets. Now, what takes place in this era with really an emerging legalism, attention to the law, the keeping of it, that's Judaism. That's new. A new development. Hebrew religion, beginning with Abraham and running down to the time of 587, is a lot more diverse and is a lot less legalistic. So when we say Hebrew religion, we mean the religious practices, the faith, and all that belongs to it in this earlier period, from Abraham down to the exile, beginning of the exile in 587. And Judaism begins in the post-exilic era. And then with the disappearance of the prophets, you have ultimately coming in their stead a whole core of rabbis, the rabbinic tradition. The rabbis are the teachers of the Torah, of the law. Upon that law, they meditated day and night. They debated law, and thought about it, and wrote about it. And that whole development of their cogitations upon the Torah belongs to the development of Judaism. So get your question in just a second. So the other day when I was saying that Judaism today, when it thinks of its sacred writings, it goes back not only now to Torah, but it goes back to the works of the rabbis as they explicated and exegeted the law. And so that's a long answer to your question, Karen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a difference between the rabbis and the priests? And the priests were from the Levite clan. Is there a difference between them? Are the rabbis the same, or were they affected a different or more scholarly function?
Yeah, there's a difference. Rabbis' function and status was different from the Levites and the priests in that primarily priests have to do with the whole cultic temple sacrificial worship business in the temple or in the synagogue. Whereas the rabbi was the steward of the law itself, the interpreter, the teacher. Now, the priests have to know what the rabbis teach, but their function in Judaism is a different one. Priest's place of function is in the holy place of worship, whereas the rabbis could be itinerant rabbis. That's what Jesus appeared to be, was a rabbi. They say, hey, they called him rabbi, teacher, and that Jesus, you know, went about with a crowd of disciples was not anything unusual at all. One, I think, sometimes thinks that, gee, that was kind of unique, wasn't it, that he gathered the 12 and people followed him around, and he would stand on a mountaintop and preach and expound and talk and speak parables. But that wasn't anything so terribly different outwardly from what a rabbi would do. Jesus looked like a rabbi. What the difference was came in the content of what he said. Okay. Other questions on that business? I'd like us to now look at some things in chapter 7 and let some questions for us, your questions as well as mine, grow out of the text. In verse 3 in chapter 7, the brothers of Jesus appear again on the scene. Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was close at hand. His brothers said to him, "You should leave this district and go into Judea, so that your disciples there may see the great thing you're doing. Surely no one can hope to be in the public eye if he works in seclusion. If you really are doing such things as these, show yourself to the world." It's interesting that Jesus' brothers are spoken about. They've been mentioned once before in chapter 2, haven't they? And I think this is the last time that they get mentioned in John, if I'm not mistaken. Well, what about these brothers? What role do they seem to play, or what role does the family of Jesus seem to play? John, what's sort of remarkable about the whole business? That always intrigues me a little bit, that talks about Jesus' brothers, his family. What's sort of remarkable about them?
You want to live so close to him, yet there's no idea what he's really about.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe it. You would think, perhaps, that if anybody would see what he's up to, it would be his family. Now, back in chapter 2, the family rejected him, thought that he was out of his mind. Here, they've had some kind of association with Jesus. They know what he's up to, and yet they don't understand either, as the verse continuing, which I didn't read at first, shows. It says, "For even his brothers had no faith in him." You're probably aware of that in later church tradition, especially in Roman Catholic tradition, that the inclination developed to regard Jesus as the only son of Mary. And that in Catholic doctrine, Mary is referred to as Perpetua Virgine. What's that, you Latin scholars? It's a perpetual virgin. Perpetual virgin. She never had any more children. Jesus is the only one. And as a result of that inclination to think of Mary as the Virgin Mary, they had to reinterpret these passages. And how did they do that? Yeah, that's right. They had to get, that's what you call, now I'm not having a polemic against my Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, but that's what you might call eisegesis. Of having, you have a doctrine that you want to maintain, which has emerged for whatever reason, and then you make the text fit your preconceived notion. Now, I mention that because we all do that a little bit, in probably more serious ways when we deal with the scriptures. At least I find that inclination is to try to make the scriptures' message often fit my world and my worldview. And Luther thought that was a bad thing. And he had a sort of homely expression to explain what you could in fact do with the scriptures. And he said that the scriptures are like an actor's wax nose. You can take that wax nose and shape it any way you want to fit the character you're trying to portray, Cyrano de Bergerac or whoever else. And that therefore we take the scriptures like a piece of wax and we mold them to fit whatever we want to. Big danger. Watch out. Don't do it. Well, that's really just a parenthetical remark that we have to keep in mind when it comes to trying to genuinely make sense out of what scriptures say to us and how we can, take them and try to apply them existentially. This note of opposition to Jesus is an important one in these chapters, or in this section, in verse 1, as well as verse 5, as well as verse 7. It's clear that the opposition is growing to Jesus. What he has to say is not very acceptable. If you look at verse 20, you have another example of opposition to Jesus as it's expressed here, an example of its expression. The crowds answer to Jesus that you are possessed. And he said, they say, who wants to kill you? They see him as paranoid. He has a sense that he's going to be killed, and they think that he's absolutely crazy. Now, in the discussion questions that I gave you, number 3 says, Jesus is accused of demon possession in 7:20, and that should be 8 verse 49 instead of 8:41. That's a typing mistake. And it continues, what is the New Testament concept of demons, and what is the background of such a concept? You meet demons a whole lot more in the Gospel of Mark or the Synoptics than you do in John. It's rather remarkable that in John, it's not the sick folk who seem to be demon-possessed, but it seems to be Jesus. Now, we might spend a few minutes on the New Testament concept of demon possession. We ought to be conscious of the fact that one could go quite a long time on talking about this rather strange way that the Bible has of talking about devils and demons, but we ought to set that against its Old Testament and ancient Near Eastern background for a moment. What about demons? What does it mean to say that Jesus was demon-possessed? How did biblical people go about using that kind of language? Does it make any sense to today to understand that in a straightforward sense, or do we have to do a little interpretation, or what? Suppose for most of us in this room, the concept of demons or demonology doesn't play a very significant role in our life. So what about that? Anybody want to venture some comments? What do you make of all the talk of demons in the New Testament? Marcy?
It's kind of hard, at least for me, and probably for a lot of other people, to talk about it in an old sense, because the first time we really ever heard of demons was like The Exorcist or something.
Yeah. Well, what else can we say besides the fact it's kind of hard to make sense of it? I don't reckon with the presence of demons directly in the way I go about my business each day. Greg?
Well, demons at that point in time, I think they were felt to cause a lot of the things that couldn't be explained, especially in the form of diseases and so on. Like somebody who had a seizure disorder was felt to have a demon who would control the person that way and so on. And you know, if they couldn't explain why somebody was acting strange or somebody had some mental illness, they felt that a demon was possessing that person. And sometimes it could be more than one demon, which could explain varying moods and so on of a mentally ill person. And this was just their way of explaining away a lot of mental illness and medical disorders that they didn't know, you know what the cause was. And they did believe in evil demons that were, you know, some evil force created demons that would go around to individual people and actually reside in that person. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Now, let's ask further, jumping off from what you've just said, does the concept of demons, therefore, belong to their worldview? All right, if we would agree that it belongs to their worldview, then what would we have to say about our own worldview? Do we share their worldview or not? To what degree do we share their worldview? If we don't share it at all, or most of it, then to talk about demons won't make a lot of sense to us. Or would it? The important thing that Greg pointed to is that primitive peoples, as well as contemporary scientific-minded people, are always on the lookout for an explanation to something, especially if it's a bit hard to understand. And in the Old Testament as well as the New, you have many examples of the explanation of a good or a bad phenomenon as either coming from a good or a bad, or good or evil, spirit. Now, in the couple hundred years that preceded the time of Jesus, you had a new development. Well, a moment ago we talked about the development from Hebrew religion to Judaism. And concomitant with that development, though not necessarily precisely corresponding to it, you had, for the Hebrew people, an evolvement or a development in their religious thinking which developed in part out of its contact with the rest of the world. Now, before that exilic period when they were deported out of there, they pretty much lived in a pocket of their own culture. But the world is opening up, and it continued to open up, and for the time of about the 4th century, the 300s, when Alexander the Great appears on the scene, you've got not only Jews living way outside Palestine, Egypt, Babylonia, and who knows where else, so that they are coming in contact with other cultures, other religions, other thinking. But you have Alexander the Great imposing upon them some Greek language and Greek ideas, etc. So in this period, there comes to be quite a ferment in the religious thinking and understanding of those Jewish people. And one of the changes that takes place, probably somewhat gradually, is a movement in the direction of what we can call dualism. This is old hat for some of you, I think. But anyway, let me explain what this is, because it stands for part of the backdrop for the question I was raising a moment ago. And I raised it about demons, not so much for the sake of a discussion about demons, but so that we understand something about the worldview of the Bible and ask some questions about the difference between that worldview and our own. In any case, in Hebraic times, in the older times, if something good or bad happened, who was the cause of it? Who was responsible? Well, Yahweh was. When I said good or bad, I didn't mean bad in the moral sense, but bad in terms of disaster. Terms of disaster. In other words, in the older Hebraic times, Yahweh was thought of as the ultimate source of all things that happened, not in a kind of deterministic sense, or not in the sense of Greek fate, that Yahweh has this strange blueprint that he's fixed before he's really created the world, and then all that happens falls into the categories of the good things that God has set out for you or the bad. That's not quite the notion. The notion is rather that ultimately, the movement of the world and the movement of history can be traced back to the will of Yahweh. That's different from a Greek or philosophical fate or deterministic view. Now, under this view, Yahweh does not stand in opposition to an evil power, or the devil, or Satan, or whatever you want to call it, whatever he has been called over the years. Yahweh doesn't share his controlling of the world with the prince of darkness. But now in the exilic period, when in Hebraic thinking, which is what this is, comes to be exposed to Eastern, Iranian, you might say Persian, kinds of philosophy, there is a change that comes about in their thinking, and that is the development of dualism. And dualism means precisely what it says. There are two dual spheres. One is good, one is evil. Each has its own head or leader, God, the devil or Satan or whatever they came to call.